I started getting really bad nosebleeds. And I lost all the hair out of my nose. It literally burned the hair from my nose. And I lost a lot of hair, my head hair. And then we all started to wonder, you know, what are we really working with?
Between Dress and Air one night, I went into the writers and I just was screaming. I said, my God, this is, it was 1983 at the time. I said, it's 1983 and we're playing Whores and Chorus Girls and, you know,
Wives.
Yeah, we're not, there's a lot of powerful women out there in the world and you're not writing for those type of women.
Gorbachev has been described as stylish, suave, sophisticated, healthy, modern, pop, healthy, has a sense of humor, enjoys the nightlife, has a pretty wife, and is very healthy. How wonderful! The Soviet Union is being run by Mick Jagger.
I'm Marge Halperin on the Chicago Beat. Tonight, Saturday Night Live star Mary Gross tells us how she traveled from Chicago to the big time, and we'll hear about some unusual but sound places to invest your IRA money or tax refund if you're lucky. There's also time for a visit to Chicago's Moosehead Lounge, for humorist Dave Jaffe to find Mikhail Gorbachev's funny bone, and Q101 sports director Pat Benkowski will take us out to the ball game. But first, we'll find out why more than 160 people claim making tennis rackets was a dangerous job, and how thousands of others around the state may face similar on-the-job dangers without knowing it. What happens when workers don't know the names of the materials they handle? When they don't know if those materials are dangerous? An employee of Elk Grove Village's Film Recovery Systems died of cyanide poisoning in 1983 while processing film chips in a cyanide solution. Four people overcome by carbon monoxide fumes earlier this year died in an Aurora oil refinery and in River Grove. More than 160 workers at the now-closed Wilson Sporting Goods plant have developed a long list of ailments, including Diane Coper's painful rash.
They always told us that it never hurt us. It was just a temporary condition that would eventually go away. However, it doesn't. It just breaks out on my skin and never goes away. And the itching is constant. No matter what you do, what kind of soap you use, how many baths you take, it's always there.
Coper and fellow workers have gone to court trying to find out exactly what they were exposed to. They claim Wilson covered labels and now may be destroying records to keep that a secret. Court documents also claim Wilson threatened workers who sought medical help.
Management pays no attention to you. I mean, it's just like, be happy you have a job. You know, and there were a couple of times that I had gone to the clinic and they had written on a piece of paper, do not go back to the job that I had. And I would give it to my boss and he would tell me, look, either you go back in there and you go to work or you go home with no pay.
Coper couldn't afford that and kept working until her life was overcome by what she says is graphite dust carried home from work.
Sometimes the dust that came off of it was so bad it was like it was snowing in the room. And I have very dark hair, and when I would walk out at the end of the day, it was white. And my car, I had to get rid of that. It was loaded with graphite. Other people would sit in it, and they'd say, my God, I'm itching. I don't understand it. And it would be the graphite that would be embedded in the material.
With the case in court, Wilson has no comment on those charges and no explanation as to why it is one of thousands of companies that have yet to comply with a year-old state right-to-know law. That law is supposed to end problems like Diane's ordering companies to turn in a list of potentially dangerous chemicals so workers can protect themselves.
If you're exposed to slap 1, 2, 3 and you notice that your hands and feet tingle and feel numb after you've been working with it, doesn't do you any good. You're not going to find slap 1, 2, 3 in any medical toxicology book, nor is any physician going to know what slap 1, 2, 3 is, and thus won't be able to treat you. But if you know that slap 1, 2, 3 is an organophosphate pesticide, then there's a connection.
That's Pat McGuire, who heads a coalition of labor unions concerned about safety. Unfortunately, too many Illinois workers are still eyeing drums of slop 1, 2, 3 because, according to the State Labor Department, only about 15% of some 79,000 companies have sent in their list of dangerous substances. So labor unions are trying to do the enforcement work that a small labor department staff can't handle. Among those fighting the hardest for the right to know is the firefighters union. The state law says companies should also send their list of potentially dangerous chemicals to local firehouses so men like Chicago Fire Department Lieutenant Carl Litz can prepare for disaster.
We don't have time to spend 15, 20 minutes or a half hour figuring out what to do. We're expected to arrive on the scene, evacuate people if that need be, and go to work. And many times after the smoke clears, you start seeing drums that maybe were leaking, and who knows what you've been involved with.
Knowing which chemicals are in their district can prevent firefighter injuries on even the most routine call. Liz remembers when co-workers went to check on a leaking can last year.
The vapors from the particular chemical permeated the standard fire clothes they had on, and they both wound up in the hospital, and to this day they still have problems with loss of pigment in their skin.
Liz is alarmed to find the very companies he's trying to protect won't cooperate, but he says if more firefighters are injured, fire inspectors will hound companies into compliance. Factories across the state will hear from more than their local fire inspectors and union leaders after calls from Q101, the lawyers for the Illinois Attorney General and State Labor Department arranged a meeting to target the biggest offenders for fines. If you have information about companies that may not be honoring workers' right to know, call the Illinois Labor Department. Saturday Night Live's funny girl Mary Gross is really Chicago's Mary Gross. Born and raised here, she still calls Chicago her home, and it seems no one is more surprised than Mary herself to find she's live from New York each Saturday night. She told Sandy Hausman how it all happened.
I actually saw an ad in the Reader for a comedy workshop, and at the time I was going to Loyola and I was majoring in English. And I thought, oh, dear God, how am I going to make a living with an English major? What am I going to teach? Is that the only alternative? And then I thought, well, maybe I could be a comedy writer. I had this fantasy from watching the old Dick Van Dyke show that would be a grand way to make a living, you know, to be in a room with a couple of people writing jokes. I answered the ad for this workshop, and there were some people up in stage that was late, and the workshop had already started. And there were some people up on stage going through some motions. And I said to one of the fellows, are we expected to get up on stage? And he said, yeah, that's how it works. I said, well, listen, how about I pay the same fee as everyone else, but I just watch. I'll just observe and learn that way. I really had no desire to get in front of people. And he said, well, that's not the way this workshop is run. You have to get up on your feet. So
I said, okay, and I reluctantly got up there and felt that I was just horrible. I was devastated by my first day at the comedy workshop. And I went home in tears and thought, I'll never go back again. It's much too humiliating. And I have a brother who's an actor, and I felt, well, that's his job in the family. He's the actor, so I have to be something else.
Yeah, his name is
Michael Gross, and he's on a show called Family Ties for NBC, and he plays the father of the family.
Boy, did your parents ever expect this?
No.
Two in one family.
But they're very sweet, humble people, so they don't sit back and say, wow, I can't believe you two are on TV. At least they don't say it to our faces, you know, because they wouldn't want us to get big-headed or feel strange about it. But I know that they're very proud that we're both making a good living, you know. Anyway, I went back to the workshop after my first go at it because I was afraid if I didn't go back that they would say, hey, remember that tall, skinny girl who came in here? Wasn't she stupid? So I felt I had to go back to protect my reputation. So I went back and I calmed down and I just decided, well, if this is the way you do it, I'll learn how to do it this way. And I got better at it.
So much better that you went on to Second City and from there to NBC. Tell us about your life now. What's it like on the set of Saturday Night Live?
We come in Monday around noon. And we have a general meeting. We discuss the last show we did and either pat ourselves in the back or kick ourselves, depending on how the show went. And then we meet the host. And the host usually comes in with a few ideas, and we give the host a few ideas. And then everybody goes off in groups. Many of our writers stay all night and just nap on their couches or whatever. I try to get out of there by 4 in the morning or so, because on Wednesday at 1 o'clock we have what's called a read-through. And that's where the actors, the writers, the producers, we all get together in a room and the actors read the scripts that have been submitted. Based on how they go and how they read, and how the producers think they can fit them into the studio, that's where they choose the material.
Seems like a lot of the material that's chosen involves Billy Crystal or Marty Short, but not Mary Gross. Does that ever bother you?
There are moments of jealousy. I mean, if I have one line on a show and another actor has six scenes, I might feel a little bad about it, but I don't feel like that actor is deliberately trying to hurt me. He didn't make the choice to be in all those scenes. He may have written a lot of good scenes for himself, and also the producer may be pushing him more than he's pushing me. And the other thing is when you're light in the show, I remember asking Billy Murray about this once. He was hosting our show a couple seasons back. And I said, did you go nuts when you were really light in the show and didn't have much to do? He said, yeah, but you can't let it get to you. You just do the best you can with what you have to do. So you have to just keep your spirits up and enjoy the show and enjoy the experience you had that week working with the host or seeing the band or whatever, and just put your focus elsewhere.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus says that the women on Saturday Night Live aren't getting the same chances or opportunities as the men. You think that's true?
I used to be appalled by the situation, and between Dress and Air one night, I went into the writers and I just was screaming. I said, my God, it was 1983 at the time. I said, it's 1983, and we're playing whores and chorus girls and,
wives.
Yeah, we're not, there's a lot of powerful women out there in the world, and you're not writing for those type of women.
Are there a lot of blow-ups as the show is put together? Do you have a lot of tempers flaring?
There are tempers flaring, and it's not that the people are bad people or really temperamental people. The problem is we're working in a pressure cooker.
Sure.
I don't want to give the wrong impression. We do have a lot of fun, and we do laugh a lot.
Yeah. But we're under such pressure. I mean, the show is put up very quickly, and a lot of people don't get sleep. And so you're walking down the hall, and it's like you have blinders on. You're trying to remember what your lines are, where you have to run between this scene and that scene to get into what wig. I mean, sometimes you have a minute to get ready for the next scene, and you just stand there with your arms out and your legs out, and the dressers and the hair people and the makeup people are doing you, and you're trying to remember what your lines are. And it's hard to always have time to just stop and chat and ask people, how's your day, you know?
Yeah. You talk about people not getting sleep. I assume that this kind of a schedule also intrudes on your personal life, your social
yes.
life, and you're a young woman. Does this get on your nerves? Is this a problem for
well,
you?
Well, my situation is that my family and my boyfriend live here in Chicago. So when I go to New York, I can focus totally on my work because my boyfriend isn't there to say, honey, aren't you coming home? Please come home. Let's have dinner together or something. It's very hard for couples that are married. They sort of become TV widows or widowers because their partner doesn't get home till 4 in the morning and they're already asleep by then.
What does your boyfriend do? Is it hard for him hanging out with a celebrity?
Oh, he's such a doll. I'm really nuts about it. We've been going out for about 7 years now, and he's a photographer, and he works here in Chicago. And he's very sweet and very tolerant, and I'm sure a lot of men wouldn't much like this situation where their girlfriend is gone half of the year and living in another city.
On the other hand, some would love it.
Yes. it's worked out well. Sometimes it makes us a little tense. If I come home for a week, by the end of the week, we're arguing with each other because, not because we're tired of each other, but because we know we have to separate again, and that makes us a little tense, you know.
Yeah. So when are you going to stop this craziness, as your parents might say, and get married?
You know, somebody said recently, or people are always asking me, when are you two going to get married? You're obviously nuts about each other and plan to spend your life together. And I said, well, Jay says we'll get married when we live in the same city. And I said, well, don't hold your breath, honey, because I don't know when that's going to happen.
And they moved Saturday Night Live to Chicago.
Yeah.
Confused by the jungle of cats, tigers, CDs, and other new investments? Or worse yet, are you bored by money markets and the few other options for small investors? Well, you have more choices than you might think. Investors who wander off the beaten path can, for instance, bank on the baby boom with a Merrill Lynch mutual fund that tracks the newest of the nouveau riche.
They're more or less moving up the professional ladder. The types of companies that would be benefiting from this would include computer companies, airlines, companies that are geared towards the baby boomers' children, such as daycare centers, baby food companies.
On the other end of the scale, investment counselor Elise Rifkin also offers a Merrill Lynch fund that tracks the sleepers, companies that seem to be headed for trouble.
The managers of the fund feel that bankrupt companies have a very good chance of turning around, being acquired by large companies. So it's a good way to get in at a low price.
Are you an investor with a conscience? Why not try one of more than a dozen alternative money market funds which steer clear of South Africa, nuclear power, and other politically controversial projects?
There used to be this idea that you couldn't do good and do well. That is no longer true. With a
well-researched division, we are able to provide a competitive yield while at the same time allowing people to earn interest on their principles as well as their principal, as we say.
Ron Froehring represents Working Assets, a fund that keeps its liberal political goals without losing sight of its monetary goals, reporting a respectable yield of about 8% last year. Social investment funds draw church groups, union pension funds, and penniless hippies who have grown into moneyed yuppies like Jeannie Ermoyan.
I've spent years and years of my life working against and for certain principles. And here I was putting my money into a fund that was working against what I had been working for. It didn't make sense.
This might not make sense, but an Omaha firm has been turning a tidy profit using sunspots to forecast changes on Wall Street. The Astro Fund was recently rated tops among 380 investment groups. But for the more traditional investor, nothing shines like gold. Though precious metals have been sluggish since their 1980 boom, gold took a big jump last week, closing as high as $339 an ounce as the U.S. dollar weakened. And if you have really big money to throw around, say $35,000 out of a net worth of $1 million, Elise Rifkin of Merrill Lynch offers you a Greyhound bus.
You actually buy a bus and then lease it back to a company that will be using it. When you actually get your bill for the bus, it lists out tires and seats and engine and everything.
But don't put all of your money into buses or any other single investment vehicle.
If you select one or two stocks, even though it may be a very, very high quality stock, something very unexpected can happen and you can lose everything.
States isn't the only country that likes its politicians to come in a nice, slick package. Humorist Dave Jaffe says the Soviets have finally found a leader who comes with a top-notch PR team.
Us guys and gals in the media have been praising Mikhail Gorbachev as a jaunty, debonair world leader just because he's the first Russian we've seen who smiles. Since his appointment, and even earlier at his meeting with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Gorbachev has been described as stylish, suave, sophisticated, healthy, modern, pop, healthy, has a sense of humor, enjoys the nightlife, has a pretty wife, and is very healthy. How wonderful! The Soviet Union is being run by Mick Jagger. Who is responsible for the glitzy packaging of Gorbachev? Some blame Western television. We could let Hollywood off the hook because of the writer's strike. Obviously, the TV media has played a part in painting this garish picture. But if we look even deeper, who's really to blame? Why, the Ruskies, of course. They've become media-wise. Somewhere deep in the labyrinthine caves of the Kremlin, tucked between the Ministry of Standing in Line and the Ministry of Watching People Who Stand in Line, lies the Ministry of Advertising and Hype. The time is mere hours after the death of Konstantin Chernenko. There, amid a sea of photographs, ad copy, and paper cups, sit the Soviet Union's three top advertising execs, Maury, Herb, and Lance. "Comrades," says Herb, "the Politburo has selected Gorbachev to carry the torch of communism through the darkness of worldwide oppression. Now, we gotta make him fly." Maury grumbles. "I wish they'd gone with Nadia Comaneci like we suggested. She would have been a cinch." Lance ponders a photo. "Oh, I don't know. Mickey here has a lot of potential. We could go with the youthful, down-to-earth thing. You know, the swinging grandpa who's not afraid to inspect the wheat field." "I have an idea," says Herb. "Now, understand, I'm just flushing this down the Volga to see what backs up. But what if we try the world peace angle? I mean, convince Gorbachev and the Central Committee that nuclear armament is madness, so why not halt the buildup?
Then the Americans see we're serious, and they strip their warheads. The rest of the world quickly follows suit. Soon free trade begins, starvation and ignorance become memories, and within decades, mankind reaches the stars. Lance and Maury stare at Herb until he shakes his head. Nah, I didn't think so. Well, maybe he could adopt Nadia Comaneci. I'm Dave Jaffe on the Chicago Beat.
The food is good at the Moosehead Lounge in Chicago's South Loop, but most people find it only whets their appetite for the star attraction, sinfully rich jazz. Dave McBride takes us to the Moosehead.
Ago, the corner of Wells and Harrison Streets, south of the Loop, was among the bleakest in the city. Across the street to the west, the ruins of an ancient viaduct. The building on Harrison, west of the Rock Island tracks, appeared destined for demolition until a year ago, when the bottom floor became the home of a new restaurant and the new South Loop's first jazz club, the Moosehead Bar and Grill. Guy Fricano played the night we visited.
I think this is a very hot area in the Loop. I think it's the hottest. Looking ahead, will be one of the newer areas of the Loop, because as you see around here, you know, there's a lot of construction going on, and Printers Row and everything, and of course Printers Row has really turned out to be quite a cute place, with all the little shops and bars and pubs and everything, Moosehead being one of them on the outer periphery, and I think this is going to be the part of the Loop to watch.
And it is true that where a year ago there was nothing but the rubble of condemned buildings and muddy vacant lots, there is now the nearly completed One Financial Place, a gateway to the Options Exchange and the Board of Trade to the north, to the east, Printers Row, to the south, Dearborn Park, and to the west, the rising skeleton of the awesome River City, with its marina and soon-to-be-occupied first 446 apartments of the 2,500 apartments under construction there. 5,000 people live in the South Loop right now, and 5,000 more when River City is finished. And its owner shrewdly guessed that a South Loop location would draw jazz lovers to the barn-like Moosehead, with its enormous Moosehead over the bar and its clutter of bric-a-brac. From a carnival midway, swing the hammer, ring the bell, and win a cigar device, to a wheel of fortune, to stuffed animals, to a four-foot-high portrait of Mayor Richard J. Daley. Bill Hayes is the manager.
It's basically a small room with the center of the room being the stage. It's done in all antiques and bearskin on the wall, a moose head on the wall, kind of a hunting lodge type of effect. But the center of the room is basically the stage, and that's our jazz, and that's where we're going.
Hayes' bill of fare is eclectic, but he admits the draw is more music than menu.
It's basically a sandwich and salad type menu. Our moose burger, which is our most popular item, and actually it's just more of a light snack, light lunch type menu. Very few entrees.
Guy Fricano, whose sextet recently recorded an album entitled Jazz Inside Out, says he has nothing against the downtown Chicago traditions like the Jazz at Noon, which moved a few years ago to Andy's on Hubbard after years at Marina City, but says the Moosehead attracts a more serious jazz than the Dixieland style featured elsewhere.
We're talking about bebop, post-bebop music, but yet we have bands that will concentrate more on the music of Billy Strayhorn, Duke Ellington, which is still great music, you know, to show tunes, as we do, you know, to a certain degree. But I think you're going to find this a more current jazz endeavor collectively on all the days, even the afternoon brunches. You know, you've got young musicians presenting fresh jazz, you know, more current jazz.
Packing the Moosehead even sooner than the River City population will be the office inhabitants of the One Financial Place Tower, in which there are desks for 5,000 people, many of whom will relax in the early evening listening to live jazz before the commute south on the RTA's Rock Island line, leaving just a block away. Most nights it's free, special occasions a $2 cover charge. The most expensive item on the menu is about $5. Moosehead beer, featured with a variety of imports and domestics. Moosehead is open 7 days and attracts the after-work office crowd weekdays, the serious jazz crowd on weekends. The Moosehead joins the Printer's Row Restaurant, the Dearborn Street Oyster Bar, eateries like Orly's and Eduardo's, and taverns like Moonraker's and Blackie's. Born as the South Loop becomes less a geographical location and more of a neighborhood. I'm Dave McBride on the Chicago Beat.
We're wrapping up another exciting winter sports season, but it wasn't exciting enough to hold the attention of Q101 sports director Pat Binkowski.
A quick look at the winter sports season shows great success for Loyola and Illinois in college basketball, a record home winning streak and more exciting indoor soccer play for the Sting, and the Blackhawks challenging for first place after Bob Pulford replaced Coach Orville Tessier. The Bulls are winning again with rookie Michael Jordan, and the organization took a dramatic turn for the better under the new ownership of Jerry Reinsdorf. But despite all these good things, I can't help but think about baseball. Not just because there's rumors about two separate dome stadiums being built, or the lights issue being rekindled, or the fact that exhibition baseball's been on for a couple of weeks. It's just a yearning to go back outside with scorecard in hand. The indoor games are a lot faster, there's a lot more scoring. Maybe it's that scoring a run in baseball is more meaningful. Maybe it's the solo confrontation of the pitcher and the hitter. It could simply be the reason to wipe out the Cubs' 3 losses at San Diego or the entire 84 White Sox collapse. But whatever the particulars, I just can't wait to be at Comiskey Park and Wrigley Field or even in front of the TV watching those late-night West Coast games, as crazy as it might seem. I'm Pat Binkowski on the Chicago Beat.
And I'm Marge Helper, and thanks for joining us tonight. You can hear the Chicago Beat the final Sunday of each month at midnight on Q101.
Town in West Glover, right here in Chicago. five-star interview with Dr. Ruth Love, Chicago School Superintendent, for just one more month. She fought hard to keep her job, even filed a $12 million lawsuit against the school board that fired her. But Love leaves with her head
held high.
I tend not to be bitter. I look to the future. I'm optimistic about the future. I think when one door closes, several open. I think it's an unfortunate political situation, but then that's the name of the game. When you're in a power position, one, you don't expect it, but you know that it could happen. I think it could have been handled much more professionally, but that's history. So, no, I'm looking to the future. It's been a very difficult, but a very good experience in many ways.
You have filed a lawsuit, $12 million, claiming sex and race discrimination in the decision not to renew your contract. There was an editorial this week, but it's not the first time anyone has said it, suggesting you leave quietly, that your lawsuit is going to do more damage to the system, especially the system that doesn't have very much money, and that maybe you should just back down and go quietly.
First of all, no one has the right to tell anyone how they leave or how they enter a situation. My lawsuit, the basis of my lawsuit is not sex and racial discrimination, but conspiracy. And that's very serious. Sex and race was a secondary cause, very serious one, but secondary cause. And therefore, I find that one has to do what one has to do. Had I filed no lawsuit, the board president would have still been
discrediting the superintendent on television. Every time I looked on television, there he was. I don't think anybody has the right to suggest how one leaves a situation. No one knows what's really occurred in this situation, so I think it's presumptuous.
People are probably wondering, though, why you're filing a lawsuit asking for money from the schools when you've worked so hard to conserve the money that the schools have.
No one made any comments when we brought in $172 million at one time. $172 million. Not, clearly, I'm not trying to get that back, but there's no doubt about the fact that we've restored some credibility in this school system, have been able to communicate with the legislature, but there are always damages, and no one says anything when other people file suits and seek damages. I wonder why they think that the superintendent should be different.
It's been just a month since another big city superintendent committed suicide, Frederick Holliday in Cleveland, and he left a note talking about the political pressures and how it interfered with him trying to do his job. It seems like in some ways a parallel situation, doesn't it? Is this a common thing in big cities where an educator has to learn the political game?
Most large city school superintendents are politically aware. They try not to be partisan. They try not to get involved in partisan politics. And they tend to remove themselves from local political situations. But there's no doubt about it. When you have a large budget and when you have an enormous staff, you're in the middle of politics, no matter where you are in this country. And there's no getting around that. That I feel is a real tragedy when you consider the loss of Fred Holliday and what he had to contribute to education in this country. It's really unfortunate. I feel very badly about that because I know the stress that can be placed on you when you know someone is after you, when you know that no matter what you do, they are going to find something wrong with it. That places a lot of stress on you, so you have to be very resilient and very strong in order not to personalize that. There are people who will have other people level attacks, leak things to the press that they know will try to discredit you, and I guess some people just aren't able to recognize that for what it is. Certainly it's never occurred to me to commit suicide, believe me. But there are different ways of fighting. You mentioned the lawsuit. I don't know of any decision that was more difficult for me to make than filing that lawsuit, because that's not my usual modus operandi. I never filed a lawsuit against anybody for anything. No one could have made me think that I would do such a thing. But I also believe in justice. And I have fought long and hard in civil rights. And I believe that people ought to be treated a certain way. And if the board doesn't want to go through having that, then they ought to learn how to treat people.
The way you describe it, you seem like you were persecuted in your 4 years here.
Oh, no. I don't feel at all persecuted. I think I dealt with some unfortunate people, both inside and outside the school system. And I understand that, but I don't feel persecuted at all. I don't leave with any trace of malice toward the situation. As a matter of fact, I am so into the future that it's hard to think about the past.
What are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm not at liberty at this moment to discuss my future plans.
Let me ask you this. There are a lot of people who think you would make a good political candidate, maybe even for mayor of Chicago. Have you thought about that?
Well, I always keep my options open. Clearly, people talk to me about all kinds of things.
What kind of a mayor do you think Harold Washington has been from a standpoint of the schools? Has he been good for the schools?
Well, I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment. I know what we had hoped would occur.
What is that? What did you think? Certainly that first day, the day after the election, he went to his old DeSable High School, and he had kids forming around him, chanting his name. What did you think then that he would mean for city schools?
Hope, even-handedness, honesty, assistance with funds, hands-off on some of the board decisions.
How would you like to be remembered?
First, I'm going to be in Chicago, so it's not as though I'm leaving the city. I will see to it that I'm not forgotten. I would like to be remembered as the person who came into a very difficult situation where, as they say, angels feared to tread. When I was told that you couldn't do anything in Chicago, the situation was so bad, you couldn't do anything. And I was really challenged and stimulated by that.
But you say you will stay in Chicago, whatever your next job or career may be. You're not leaving.
I will be in Chicago, yes. I'm a homeowner in Chicago, so I have no plans for getting rid of my home, my condo, as it were. And I like it here.
Have you been approached by anyone to run as a mayoral candidate?
Oh, sure. Well, lots of people get approached by more than one. Groups, individuals, everybody who has a bright idea thinks that they can do that.
Are you a Democrat?
Well, you aren't supposed to ask that question.
Not necessarily, huh?
Well, I'm certainly not necessarily the other either. But let me say that my actions are clearly independent.
It's a typical Wednesday night in Chicago, and millions of people are watching TV. The top-rated show is Dynasty, but second place goes to a surprise, as Sandy Hausman reports.
Look at this studio, filled with glamorous prizes, fabulous Wheel of Fortune is the top-rated syndicated show in American history. The program is so popular that one version is seen on Channel 5 each morning, while another airs at night on Channel 7. Wheel is leading the pack of prosperous game shows which now glut the airwaves. In the late 50s, quiz shows suffered a near-fatal blow when viewers found out that contestants on the $64,000 question were sometimes given answers in advance. Walter Podrajic, author of Watching TV, says the public was appalled.
They had put their trust and they had really identified tremendously with the programs. And then to be told it was all play acting really produced very negative effect. So for a few years, the networks pulled back almost completely, especially on any sort of big money game shows, both in daytime and in prime time.
But in the late 60s, Chuck Barris put a show called The Dating Game on, and the slow comeback for quiz shows began. There are now 13 game shows on the air here, their popularity fueled by the trivia craze and by the ever-present American dream to get something for nothing. The most successful shows offer big prizes, but that's not all. They need good contestants.
People the viewers can cheer for. I like the little old people.
I love to see the old people win. I think it's really neat.
People who usually say they're down on their luck and they've got an opportunity to better themselves through a game show, I think it's great.
Oh, the women! Of course! The ones I would root for are the ones that have the worst luck. You know, lose a turn, bankrupt. You know, that's the poor devil I'm rooting for.
The ones that get up there and go for it, gamble for it, give the wheel a big spin and say, come on, you know, and really go for it. I don't like somebody that gets up there and spins two times and they're scared to death they're going to lose the money, because you're going out there to go for it and give it all you got. To find good players, the Wheel of Fortune and other shows screen carefully. A crew came to Chicago this winter and talked with hundreds of potential players.
If the category is things, a plural category, what's a good letter to call up?
Yes.
It makes things plural. If you see a three-letter word
in addition to coaching would-be contestants on strategy, the associate producer asked people to play the game to see how they handled victory and defeat.
I'd like a D.
No.
Oh. All right, Big Money 2000. I'd like a T, please. I'd like an R, please. Oh, good!
Popular game shows also get home viewers to play along. Wheel of Fortune, for example, is a variation on the pen and paper game called Hangman. Players guess letters in a mystery word or phrase and finally solve the puzzle. That's easy enough, and TV expert Walter Podrajic says being easy is important to the success of today's programs.
If you want an education, you'll go flip to public television. If you want to just have fun and play along, then you want relatively simple questions, which is why something like Family Feud, for instance, is, in effect, a perfect set of questions. You don't have to know anything. All you have to do is guess, given a pool of people similar to you. What would they say, given the situation? And the puzzles, so to speak, that are used on Wheel of Fortune are pretty straightforward. I mean, straight from the horse's mouth was one I saw in an episode the other day. Not real difficult, not some obscure Latin phrase, not the title of some 1929 treatise on Marxism. I mean, this is pretty standard pop culture.
Now, some shows offer no challenge at all. Instead, Podrajic says they rely on some other form of entertainment.
I'll go for the curtain. You're going to go for the curtain? All right. Let's take a look and see what's behind the curtain that you just traded for. And there are some handy home appliances.
Let's Make a Deal is one of those programs where viewers find little challenge but lots of wacky contestants in costumes to keep them amused. They also see Monty Hall, a veteran game show host who knows how to keep his show moving.
I play the game. I have the fun. I do the turn of the screw. In other words, if I'm going to make a deal with you and you now own what's behind the curtain and we don't know what it is, now I will say to you, before we see what's back there, and this key fits it. It could be a birdcage or it could be a car. I'll offer you $300 for the key, $350, $400, $450, $500. Now, what I'm doing is I'm watching you at the same time, because if you look like the kind of a person who will sell out very quickly, then I'll take my time with it and I'll go in smaller amounts to get the dramatic effect. But if I look at you and I can see no way am I going to sell off this key, then I'll make dramatic leaps. I'll go from 300, 600, 900, 12, I'll give you $1,500.
Here's the grocery tape. What's the bottom line here? What?
$182? I'm going to pay you five times that amount, or $910 a day.
They all do. What's Make a Deal is a 7-8.
And finally, a good game show offers a little humor. People like to smile, and Pat Sajak, who hosts Wheel of Fortune, does his best to provide some light laughs. The answer to a puzzle was once the Gettysburg Address, but the young contestant didn't have her history down. The Bettysburg Address, she said. Sajak had her repeat the answer, then ruled it wrong. Later, he consoled the woman by pointing out that the speech was made by Abraham Binken. But the best laugh goes to the industry. In a city like Chicago, commercials in quiz shows can sell for up to $8,000 a minute. That's some prize for producers and for television stations, which win big each time a game show is aired.
Okay, on the count of three, we'll all say goodbye. One, oh, we're out of time.
Bye!
And I'm Sandy Houseman, saying so long on the Chicago Beat.
Diet Shasta, now with a great taste of music sweet, you'll say, I want a pop, Diet Shasta.
This is Q101 WKQX Chicago. Let's take a few minutes now to indulge a new dad, humorist Dave Jaffe.
Say, you want to talk about my kid? Good. His name is Russell, and he's 9 months old, and every once in a while he helps his daddy pay the rent by doing things that every child on earth has done, but it's become vogue for daddies to write about their babies in a touching, humorous, yet sensitive manner. We can thank Alan Alda for that. Anyway, the most touching, humorous, yet sensitive thing my kid has done recently is join me on a trip to the supermarket. I hadn't expected any surprises at the store since I rarely dawdle when I shop. I don't depend on a shopping list, and instead I just take one of everything and hope for the best. This wouldn't leave Russell any time to get fussy as he sat backwards in the cart watching all the pretty food groups go by. So here I am, minding my own and my baby's business in the canned vegetable section, when I have that eerie feeling I'm being watched. Nearby stand two elderly ladies keeping me under close scrutiny. "You should keep baby out of the frozen food section," says one. He ain't dressed warm enough for frozen foods. I assure the woman that although Russell is wearing a snowsuit thick enough to stop hard radiation, I won't subject him to anything cooler than baked goods. Later, as I'm pulling a cereal box down from the shelf, another woman happens by and strikes up a conversation with Russell. "What's the matter, baby?" she says. "Did Mommy leave you all alone?" I turn back and explain very nicely that the child's with me. She stares, then nods slowly, deliberately, all the while looking around for a children and family services agent. I hurry away. At the checkout line, Russell, who is perfect in all ways, lets out a yelp that says he's through shopping and it's time to get going right now. I give him a graham cracker to buy some time, but the checkout lady frowns with disapproval. "Are you sure he should have that?" she warns. I tell her no, but he couldn't open the olives. Hey, I'm a 1980s kind of guy, but what good is that when it's still 1950 in the supermarket? But I've learned my place. Next time I take baby out, we're heading straight for the boxing ring or the racetrack. I'm Dave Jaffe on the Chicago Beat.
Restaurant Florence on Taylor Street in the heart of Chicago's Little Italy looks like a restaurant you'd find on the streets of Florence, Italy, and that's part of the explanation for its name. Owner Florence Scala decided she'd open a restaurant after visiting Italy.
At first I thought about importing, but that was way out of my ken. And then I thought about just doing a small restaurant. I don't know why people think about doing a restaurant, because it's one of the most difficult businesses to develop, you know? But women are always thinking crazy things like that.
Florence is no stranger to Taylor Street. She lived there all her life and was recently honored by the Center for Neighborhood Technology for leading the fight against the University of Illinois back in the 60s. Florence even ran for alderman twice, hoping to stop the university from splitting up her neighborhood. She lost on all counts. But even with that background, she found the restaurant tough going for a while.
Just learning how to order, how to plan, for how many lunches, for how many dinners. At first, I used to plan as though this room was going to be filled up at every seating. Well, that was ridiculous. Similarly, I used to think that everybody would want the specials, but that I soon learned that that's not so, you know. Then to get accustomed to putting in as many hours as I had to in the beginning, from 6:30 in the morning till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning at first.
But it wasn't long before the restaurant became standing room only. Not hard, really, with only about a dozen tables. Each customer seems more satisfied than the last.
This is all I've ever gotten in here.
That's what you had today?
Yes, I did.
How was it?
Excellent as always.
I think it's a very unique Italian restaurant because they offer their pasta, but they also offer a lot of more northern Italian. A lot of veal, chicken, and seafood fare. Not real heavy.
I had a salad, and it was the best salad I've had in many, many years. I'm happy that it's here, and I'll come again.
The secret is in the sauce. Florence cooks Northern Italian style, light, flavorful dishes with only 2 tomato sauces on the menu.
Everything else is either vegetable sauce, a fish sauce, and then gorgonzola sauce is very nice. It's just cream and butter, gorgonzola and milk, and Parmesan cheese. And then a dish that's sold all over Italy, aglio olio, which is just simply garlic that's been browned in lovely olive oil with toasted walnuts and pasta.
The daily specials always include the popular fillet of chicken, sautéed in butter and light olive oil and served with lemon wine sauce. Florence also has a veal and seafood dish on the handwritten specials menu. The prices are moderate. Dinner for two will cost at least $20, more if you select from the wine list drawn up by Florence's brother. The Florence restaurant is a family affair. A giant mural of Florence, Italy, is Florence's brother's copy of a 15th century painting. He's also the one who restored the fine woodwork in the dining room that used to be Florence's dad's tailor shop. Florence's husband and kids occasionally help out, too. That's just one of the elements of a restaurant few seem able to resist.
It's all these things, Paul. The quality of food, the quality of the people, Florence's persona and personality. The waitresses are outstanding, and the general ambiance.
Among those drawn to Florence, the locals, the toughest patrons to please in a neighborhood drenched in Italian restaurants.
This is a real neighborhood area. I mean, people eat at home rather than eating out. So when they did begin to come in, I was really more thrilled to see them, really, because that is a test.
Florence thinks she passed that test because her northern Italian recipes, researched from volumes of cookbooks, don't compete with the spaghetti houses nearby. That's one reason. And then there's that special security that comes with the homey atmosphere.
The last Italian restaurant I was at was along the street. This was some years ago, and someone came in and grabbed the bag. So you have to be careful. You have to choose which ones you go to.
Florence is located at 1030 West Taylor Street. If you're going there on the weekend, call for reservations and allow extra time to
find the rare parking spaces in that neighborhood.
Ever wonder how people who scream for a living at the Board of Trade manage to make their voices last a lifetime? Dave McBride answers this nagging question for us.
When I'm calling you,
Fire Express 75! Fire Express 75!
I will answer to.
Trades in the pits and the floors of the Board of Trade of the Options Exchange at the foot of LaSalle Street is like screaming for the home team nonstop in a football game that lasts 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, year after year without end. The rules of the exchanges require trading by open outcry, and anyone who has watched the action on the trading floor, to the untrained eye, pure madness and chaos, will recognize the deafening chorus that is that open outcry. This is the sound of commerce, but is not music even to the ears of the pit traders, who have to have a high tolerance to high decibels. And in the pits, your voice may be your fortune, your ability to yell louder than the next guy. And a lot of traders have the problem experienced by Marty Doyle.
What was happening was I'd be trading an awful lot one day when it would be busy, and at the end of the day I'd be hoarse.
Well, that was okay. It didn't bother me. And then after a while, the next couple of days, I'd be just as hoarse, and I couldn't talk anymore. So then I'm stuck with trading with a small group of people in a small area right around me. So I'd come home, and I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't even talk to my wife and kids because I had to save my voice for the next day.
One day, Marty Doyle went to a seminar, and that was his salvation. There he heard Bill Rush, a professional voice coach who recognized the need for a service and filled it. Bill Rush trains traders how to yell louder, because the more one's heard, the more business one does.
One of the common errors that a trader would make, and anyone who's ever been in that environment, just as a visitor even, much less be down inside of it and have to deal with it, is I can't hear myself think. It's almost being functionally deaf. If you try to overcome the sound, to blast over, to blast through, to drown out the opposition, so to speak, you're doomed to failure. Very often people will put their voice down real low because it sounds louder internally. And out front it actually is softer. We bring the pitch up. This makes it louder.
Bill Rush is trained as a conventional voice instructor, but learned new things about voice projection, trying to fill a stadium performing the national anthem, and in his work coaching cheerleaders. And so he took Marty Doyle under his wing, and we listened in on one of the lessons in which Marty Doyle learned strainless shouting.
4875! 4875!
In Bill Rush's office, located rather appropriately in the Civic Opera building, Marty learned how to breathe, how to control his diaphragm. He learned about pitch. He learned to yell.
75!
All right, now, wait a minute. You feel what I heard?
Yeah.
All right.
75 at the hour!
All right, that's a lot better. Less air went through, less strain, less push.
Do you ever have any complaints from your neighbor, sir?
You'll note the location of my office. It's between two banks of elevators.
And so the great work continues. Wherever there are traders suffering laryngitis, wherever there are voices straining to be free, there will be Bill Rush giving new meaning to the term market volume. I'm Dave McBride. On the Chicago Beat.
Marge Halperin, join me the final Sunday of every month on the Chicago Beat.
This is Q101 WKQX Chicago. I'm Sandy Houseman. Join me now as Q101 meets Jamaica's Minister of Tourism, Mr. Hugh Hart. It is bitter cold here in Chicago, not an ideal time to be visiting. Nonetheless, Jamaica's Minister of Tourism has forsaken the sunshine, the sea, and the sand to come and talk with us about his nation and about the opportunities for Chicagoans to visit Jamaica.